All right, welcome everyone. It's Friday evenings. Cancel the Cabal on People's Internet Radio. I'm Stephen Roberts. I've got a plethora of guests tonight. But first, my main guest is Nathaniel Sewell, a.k.a. Robert Charles Hall.
right.
Welcome to the show, Robert.
Thank you, Stephen. I'm glad to be here tonight with you and all the other guests. It'll be should be an enlightening conversation.
Yes, absolutely. I'm not sure how we got in contact. I don't remember now. You might have contacted me, I think, but you have written a book, and this book is called Bobby's Socks.
Right. I wrote Bobby's Socks several years ago, and what spurred me to write it, obviously, is I had a childhood that was not ideal, like it sounds like several others here. But beyond that, I read a article about the epigenetics suicide, which obviously are very tough subjects, both of them in their own individual silos. But I read the article. It kind of indicated that there was some real science behind it, that the thoughts that I had when I was a younger man were not just me being crazy, but the fact that my body had actually been compromised by trauma. From that, I have a little bit of an experience being in the medical malpractice insurance business for 20 years. So I know what it's like to deal with traumatic situations. So that part didn't scare me too much, but the medicine I understood at a good level, not an expert, obviously, but certainly understood it. And I got a little angry. So I wrote the story, shared it with my wife. She said, you know, you really ought to try to get it published. And I wasn't sure I wanted to do that. That's why I use a pen name, Nathaniel Sewell. It's not because I'm channeling my inner Mark Twain. At the time.
Go ahead. Are you still there?
Yeah.
Okay. I kind of lost you there for a few seconds.
No, I wrote the story, and it really relates to a lot of the work that's been done at the Sackler Program for Epigenetics at McGill University. The science is they have a Quebec suicide brain bank, and they isolated out tissue samples, and they found that part of the sample of folks who had a history of child sex abuse that also had committed suicide had a common gene mutation. So that in and of itself kind of spurred me on, but that's where the socks come in. And, you know, I kind of imagined it like yarn. You know, your DNA is strands of helical-shaped DNA that has your genetic code on your molecules. So that's where the socks come in. So I actually had, for years, worn colorful, crazy socks, even though I was a quite successful business person.
Are you still there?
They had no idea who I am. So that's where it comes from. And the story advanced. I didn't promote it very heavily because, quite frankly, it's a tough, as we're all aware, it's a very tough subject. So you have to kind of gird yourself eventually and just decide that you're not going to worry what other people think anymore. And you should go out there and try to help kids. And that's ultimately what my goal is to provide an access point for kids in a very simple, simplistic way to look at the socks and say, well, what are they really about? What are we doing here? And it conveys to them, in part, the science behind the book. And that's the direction I went, because I really felt like my own individual story was pretty garden variety. But what really concerned me was, after I read several articles about young men, young boys, really teenagers, that had taken their lives. And that just angered me, that they just didn't feel like they were empowered to talk. They didn't feel like they were empowered to seek help. Maybe they were just trying to survive. Sometimes within the home, as we've been discussed in the prior venue, within the home itself, the ability to survive that environment can be extremely difficult. 75-80%, I believe, is the statistic that the abuse comes from within the family, 80%. So it's a crazy number. There aren't that many Jerry Sanduskys out there per se, but when they show up, you know, they get your attention. But that also spurs me along, because the focus then within the media is on the perpetrator, the predator, the George Reardon, Dr. Reardon, the Jerry Sanduskys, and the list goes on. But what about the victim, and how do they get therapy, and how can they figure out a way?
Are you still there?
And realize that they're not. Yeah, I'm here.
Okay. Yeah.
That they're not crazy.
Well, yeah.
That their body has been biologically attacked.
Yeah, it's just a signal or something keeps getting a little bit wobbly. I wanted to bring in Bill and see if maybe he can make a comment on what your situation was, Robert. Bill.
Hi, Robert. It's nice to meet you.
You too, Bill.
I'm speaking to you from Los Angeles, and I run an organization you may be familiar with. It's called the National Association of Adult Survivors of Child Abuse. So obviously, in the course of the many years that I've been doing this, I've spoken to, I guess, thousands of us, because I am a victim too, a survivor. and I have, you know, I have a perspective that's perhaps useful in this, you know, in this discussion, of course, and I'd be happy to comment on any particular thing you'd like. But I agree with you that while Jerry Sandusky is, you know, an anomaly, he's also, I disagree in this, in the fact that to me, he's also the tip of the iceberg, because yes, he's famous, and that's the one thing that makes him perhaps separate from other pedophiles, but there are thousands and thousands and thousands of Jerry Sanduskys operating at any one time. And I just want people to understand that he's not unique. He's a typical run-of-the-mill pedophile, with the exception that he comes from a famous football program. Otherwise, his activity is exactly like many others, at least one-third of who are caregivers like he was, and the other two-thirds are family members, you know, for the most part. So that's another thing we need to make sure people understand.
It is, and piggybacking on that, you're right. I mean, the Jerry Sanduskys end up in the press and get noted for the obvious reasons. Right. But yeah, there are literally thousands out there that abuse, that by and large get away with it. An example that I'm going to use right now, and I have a reason for it, is the doctor, you might be familiar with Dr. George Reardon in Connecticut. Mm-hmm. The doctor was an endocrinologist by training, apparently, and he would take pictures of kids. And he died, I believe, in 1998, I believe, I'm going from memory on that. But a young couple bought his house, and it was an old house, so they decided to remodel part of it. They knocked down a wall, and they found literally hundreds, if not thousands, of pictures of children that Dr. Reardon had taken over a 30-year career. Mm-hmm. What's chilling to me about that is that's very common within the pathology. Mm-hmm. The book I wrote, Bobby Sox, Mr. Diabolus, I found out about Dr. Reardon after the fact, by the way. It's exactly what he was doing, Polaroid picture. And, you know, those kind of actions, the victim with a picture out there, the police are going to find it, and they're going to find these folks, and they're going to be exposed again. And, you know, the trauma gets repeated, if you will. And it to me is an example of our system in essence looking the other way, because the hospital knew he was a problem, but instead of taking action, confronting him, they let him go along with his quote unquote work, not unlike some of the work that you all described earlier with Kinsey. And, you know, there are thousands of children, now adults, who live with that scar for the rest of their life. And it's a literal scar on their genetic code. The work that's been done at the Sackler program there at McGill, to me, was eye-opening. It may, you know, Bill, you may have already heard of it and be quite aware of it. I was not. Being a survivor of trauma, having those thoughts in my head as a young man and not being able to tell anybody, mm-hmm. you know, you feel victimized twice. Mm-hmm. And to me, the children in particular, it's about brain development. It goes back again to your prior conversation. You know, when you're a young child, number one, your body's going to react. It's just going to do it. It's not, you don't have control over your, mm-hmm. your physical organs in that sense. And over time, that trauma will not go away. And their brain, until you get to be, I think it's around 23 to 24, is not fully developed. So your ability to react and deal with trauma is much different. So my point with all that is, another aspect that I learned is that the third leading cause of death is between ages 10 and 24, is suicide. Now, I know some of those are profoundly mentally ill people, schizophrenia, etc. But I'm going to bet you within that subclass that there are a significant number of children that just didn't have the ability to get an outlet, to get therapy, to be able to talk. And to me, that is a crime in and of itself. And I believe that figuring out a way to get those kids to kind of come out and talk to somebody, even if it's one of their friends. You know, the idea that, you know, you could see somebody wearing, and socks are very vogue right now, particularly, you know, colorful ones. If they could actually see those socks and say, why are you wearing weird socks? And the other person can say, well, they're about this. And they may not say anything, but maybe those kids begin to talk among themselves. And that, to me, creates fertile ground for them to, one, not do anything that's permanent, realize they're not crazy, and they can learn about the literal science behind it. One of the things we're doing, and part of the reason that I had contacted Stephen, I'd actually contacted him through Connie Lee, who had been trying to put together a documentary. She'd gone out, I think it's 115 different cities, and filmed folks just like ourselves who have are survivors, and I'd like to think we're all thrivers, really, of a trauma. And she recommended I contact Stephen. So that's kind of where the relationships came from. But I adapted the book into a screenplay. I have a friend of ours who is in the Directors Guild and had read the book and said, you know, it really sets up quite nicely for a film. But we look at it not as some sort of major motion picture, some life type film, but an educational opportunity. You can take that science and get it down to a level that those kids understand, put a professional workbook with that film, and make it available for teachers to teach about the issue. That, to me, would be the value of all that. I changed the ending of the book and for a variety of reasons. In particular, if I could rewrite it, I would write it like the screenplay because of the law of unintended consequences. You know, sometimes the victim takes action that they shouldn't take, and there are consequences for that. And that has to be the rational ending. And so we're trying to raise funds to get the film up and running. It takes time. As you're well aware, Bill, living in Los Angeles, there's a lot of folks running around with screenplays in their back pocket. So we are pursuing that. The gentleman I work with is an ex-Disney executive, so it's not just, you know, it's not some pie in the sky venture. We're very much pushing forward. We got our campaign up on Kickstarter. If you go to Kickstarter and film drama and look for Bobby Socks, you'll see my.
I'll go and get that link now. Your
Jill,
voice is shush for a minute. Yes, David.
I wanted to go ahead and ask Robert and Bill. We didn't get to hear much of Maggie's story on your show. I thought maybe we'd get 5 minutes out of Maggie. Is that okay?
Yeah.
Ask Maggie. Yeah.
Sure.
Hello, Maggie. Welcome to the show.
Yep, I'm here. I grew up in East Germany, and my father was a pedophile, and I had a long, long road to go to become a survivor and a thriver. I really liked that, Bill. well, it's not much to it. It's hard to talk about these issues because back in those days it was still a big taboo, and what you mentioned before is right. At that time you didn't really had anyone to talk to. So the whole secrecy about it was the main problem for me for a long time.
Well, you are a survivor, so that is a good thing. Well, I guess we can continue on. What is well, you happened to mention to me yesterday in the call, Robert, that you're not looking for really major stars or anything. Have you looked into the Cannes Film Festival? I know a lot of smaller organizations. And
we would love. We're just trying to get it up and running now, and trying to. I guess the best way to put it is. Enough funds to really kind of push it forward in terms of getting it set up and potentially optioned. I think the story, unfortunately, is kind of timeless. I think the bright spot in why I am hopeful going forward is, you know, the days of it being taboo.
Yes, absolutely. Do you feel comfortable on telling your childhood story, or?
Pardon? Sorry.
Do you feel comfortable on telling your childhood story?
I talk about it a little bit. Mine was within the family, and I had. It's funny. It's not just a person. Sometimes people get the idea that it is that individual that perpetrates the manipulation, if you will. But it's not. So I don't go a long way into that for the simple reason that I think it takes the story away from the focus. I don't have time to sit around and cry. I did all that. That's behind me. My view is going forward is, okay, what can I do to help kids today, right now? What can I do to help them to not feel like I felt when I was that age? Or is there a way to create the predicate for them to figure out how to help themselves? and get help and not end up in as an adult survivor in Bill's organization, which is a very good organization, by the way. I am familiar with it. A lot of good work going on there, tremendous work. And saving those lives to me is what it really matters to me, Stephen. I don't worry too much about my own particular situation. It's sad. My wife, unfortunately, knows the whole thing. That was probably the hardest day of my life when I had to tell her.
Yeah, certainly. So, I imagine it would be.
It's for anybody. I'm not unique. It's the same for everybody.
Sure.
Anybody goes through that process, they have to work through those feelings. And ultimately, if depending on what kind of relationship they're in,
sure.
If they want to have a positive long-term relationship, you gotta be truthful.
Yeah. If you didn't tell her, it might've come out some other way. So who knows?
Oh, without question. Eventually it would have happened. She already noticed I was a little bit different when it came into issues of intimacy, which is, you know, a common problem. I grew up in a very religious family. We grew up Southern Baptist. So, you know, not only did I have the shame of being a child that all of a sudden had been sexualized, because once you're sexualized at a young age, your brain thinks, your body thinks, okay, you're an adult now. And so it reacts as such. But if it happens when you're 10 years old, you know, you're suddenly in hyperdrive, if you will. And certainly the pathology is either hyper or hypo. I happen to be hypo. I was, you know, because of the religious background I had, I was extremely cautious. But I was also a popular kid. So I had girls that liked me that didn't understand why I wouldn't ask them out for dates, or I would go out with them, but it was almost like we were just hanging out together as friends because I didn't want to get touched. I didn't want to endeavor into that world because I wasn't sure. And I had a religious underpinning there that created shame, created guilt, it created issues of sexuality that is just not fair to a kid. And to me, you gotta, if you don't have an outlet, it takes a lot just to survive.
Yes,
and that is the key issue to me, is just because there's a lot of kids, if you talk to them, they're not going to say anything. But if they know, just get through this and survive and focus forward, they might get through it. They might be able to survive. You know, if you had a father as a predator, as pedophiles as noted earlier, that is as tough as it gets within the family. You don't have any place to escape. And so it's extremely difficult to go forward into society, because normally people ask you questions. They interact with you. So do you ball up and hide? I did, even though I was friendly and funny. I had a good sense of humor. That was also my coping mechanism. That's how I worked through it. I had a good sense of humor. That's, if you watch my pitch video, that's why I did it the way I did. I had to be more in tune with who I am, because the subject matter is extremely difficult. I will tell you that when I wrote Bobby Sox originally, I had to pick up the phone and call friends, because in part, some of the book is autobiographical. But I had to call friends and say, by the way, I wrote a book. And I would hear them go, oh, great. I bet it's funny, isn't it? And I went, well, not so much. And they said, well, what's it about? I said, child sex abuse and suicide. And on the other end of the phone, I would hear crickets.
The crickets.
I literally would sit there and listen. They didn't have anything to say. I mean, they just were stunned that I would write a book about child sex abuse and the epigenetic link to suicide. And I remember a couple of them just looked at me like they couldn't process it. Thankfully, my wife is much smarter than I am, and she said that I have a lot of friends that aren't going to be able to talk to you. They won't say anything to you. They won't read your book, not because they don't love you, but because they just don't want to go there. I think that's a fairly common theme in society, and that's what makes the work that goes on with folks like Bill so important, is it sort of tears back that tape and starts the conversation. And that's where the therapy to me begins, the healing begins. And that's when I came up with, I just thought the sock metaphor was perfect for that. You can delve as deep into it as you want or not. Just go buy a pair of socks and just wear them and feel comforted by that. I looked into a lot of those areas, and certainly given my background, I look at it not just from a scientific standpoint, medical standpoint, but obviously from the legal standpoint, and you know, carrying the conversation forward. You know, it frustrates me when I see judges give predators 30 days in jail or what have you,
or nothing.
Or nothing. And that is beyond my comprehension to understand that they don't appreciate that victim, typically a young person that not have, you know, that you have power and control over another human being, is not.
Can I ask you a question? Maggie, we can hear you battering away again. You've got to turn your volume off when you go clunkety, clunkety, clunk.
Okay.
What about the genetic mutation or change that you're discussing? Would you like to explain that a little bit more to me?
Absolutely. It's actually the term is epigenetics, E-P-I, and then genetics. It comes from the Latin above.
Mm-hmm.
Epi. If you want to look it up, look up the Sackler Program for Epigenetics. It's S-A-C-K-L-E-R, and that's at McGill University in Canada. The science really has been pushed by Drs. Meany and Seif. They're the ones that are the heroes here. I read the work they did from the Quebec Suicide Brain Bank, and they've had a theory about how our environment, food we eat, air we breathe, water we drink, can affect and change our bodies. It comes in part from a Spanish study in respect to twins, how twins have the exact same DNA, and yet one might get cancer at a younger age and the other one wouldn't. And the issue becomes, well, how do they live their lives? And so that's where the science has kind of been advancing. Initially, they were kind of looked at as quacks, but they've been able to prove their theories. I obviously read it from the standpoint of from child sex abuse and the fact that it marks the genetic code. It mutates and attacks the, and for lack of a better way to put it, the stress genes. It goes into the hypothalamic part of your brain, the long-term memory part, and it erodes the ability of a victim to be able to deal with stress. And that's where the ultimate suicide sometimes happens. It's not a direct causal link, but it's part of the story, if you will. And that's where I originally got the idea for the socks, because I thought about it in terms of yarn and that sort of thing. So I thought it would be an easy triggering mechanism for a younger person or an adult, really, to get a pair of socks and say, I'm part of this. I'm okay. And in essence, it helps calm them down, because if you even fake smile, it releases endorphins. So even if I happen to be wearing a funny pair of socks and you smile at me and you think it's weird, the fact that you release those endorphins within your brain, that chemistry, actually makes you feel a little happy. And that's part of the book, actually. The psychiatrist in the book realizes that he's on edge, like many of us have been, and she's got to figure out a way to help him calm himself down and deal with his issues. She's got to give him the toolkit he needs to survive. And that's part of an overall overreaching program. It's not just dispensing drugs. I created the psychiatrist obviously from experience and also from reading several articles about talk therapy, how a lot of psychiatrists really dispense drugs more so than they really sit and talk with a patient. You know, those days of sitting there and going, Stephen, how do you feel about yourself? You know?
Yeah.
Tell me about your mother. I mean, right. that stuff is, just doesn't happen in those offices.
Exactly. I went to a psychologist like four times and, that was about it. I was there for 15 minutes and I got a prescription and that was about the extent of it. But I forgot to mention, Robert, that, Jillian is a degreed sociologist and, she's actually thinking about going back to uni here pretty soon, but, I don't know.
Awesome. Yeah, I'm sort of a lot of psychology. Philosophy is my main thing. But I am I won't say anything else to that. Yeah, I'm thinking of doing my master's at the moment. But I probably will. But the point is, Stephen meant that in terms of psychology, I think, and I do understand a little bit about that.
I did put
a link in the chat box. Yeah. I've put a link in the chat box for people who want to look at the epigenetics of that. And Maggie, you've looked at that a lot too, about your hippocampus and your amygdala and stuff, haven't you?
Yes, I did.
I wanted to mention, Jill, that, epi is actually the root word of epic. I don't know if that means anything to you or not, but.
It's also the beginning of epicenter.
Yes, it is.
Epi, yeah, it's an interesting thought. Bill, are you there?
I am here.
Yes, still number five is still alive. So that's really interesting, because I've been looking at suicide as being a form of anger turned inwards, and I was just having a little read about the beginning of your life, Nathaniel, and saying that you were thinking of once you'd been molested or raped or whatever word you choose to use for it, you then were very suicidal.
Yeah, I had thoughts of taking my life. I mean, I had friends, one in particular that is a great guy, still a dear friend of mine, but he used to carry a 9mm handgun underneath his in his car underneath his seat. And I would look at the gun, and I thought, you know, I could steal that gun, and I knew what I would do with it.
Before he could do anything, right?
Oh, yeah.
I wonder, Robert, do you think that's a form of communication, children thinking and maybe attempting suicide? You think that's their communication, device?
It's overused probably, yeah. But it's a cry for help for sure. Yeah. I think anybody that goes down that path, sometimes they feel like they have no other option. And I see kids that are bullied. Obviously, this gets into a whole different subset of other areas. But, you know, adults do it. I mean, it's an area where if you feel powerless and you feel like there's no point to all this, and at a certain age, you know, you just don't want to tell somebody, oh, by the way, I got molested when I was 10 years old. I mean, it's not exactly the kind of conversation that pops up at cocktail parties. And it is deeply personal. And I think creating fertile ground for kids and young adults and anybody really, kind of what Bill does in particular, is giving people the avenues to talk therapy. To me, obviously drugs and things like that are useful, no question. However, I think the ability to just talk to somebody and kind of get the toolkit in your head that you're not a crazy person, but you're just having these thoughts because, for lack of a better way to put it, you're just embarrassed. I mean, something happened to you that profoundly altered the trajectory of your life. I mean, I had high IQ tests, but I didn't have great grades. And so the teachers would look at me like, what is wrong? What are we missing? And it's common. I mean, I'm just like a lot of other kids that, you know, I was the funny kid, or I was the one that just sort of didn't say anything. And that's pretty common. But I think that a lot of those kids, they just don't feel empowered to talk and to seek help. And that to me is kind of what drives me. I had those thoughts when I was a kid. They haven't, you know, and I see the in the news day in and day out what happens. You know, another aspect of this is you got a 20 plus year old, you know, teachers that are attacking 16 year old boys. I mean, that's not any different to me than a man, attacking a young girl. I mean, their brain development is slightly different, but still it's an attack to me. So. Did I answer your question?
Yes, it did. Absolutely. I've said this on air a few times, but I don't really know whether anything happened to me when I was a boy. I've had flashes many, many years ago, but they don't come anymore. You know, I've just had little situations come into my head and little pictures and that, but I'm not really sure if anything ever happened or not.
That's really interesting, Stephen.
Yeah.
Stephen, does that bring us towards female pedophiles?
Oddly enough, the both cases happen to be female cousins, Jill. So I guess from what I've been hearing from you and others that it's nearly 50-50 with men and women being child molesters.
Well, this is the thing. This is the thing. We women have got away with murder. When I was at university last time, I started looking into female pedophiles, and I got dragged. I wrote an article called Maniacal Madonnas, and it was about because sort of like Buddha, I came to learning a lot of these things very late in life, to the point that they're a complete shock value for me. And when I first met people who'd been molested by women, I went white hot. I was an adult. I already had two children the first time I even heard that there were female pedophiles. And literally my whole body just went white hot with the shock that there are women pedophiles. That's how innocent we are. And now, you know, the statistic was when I was at uni, the one that I got from Australia, was 1 in 4 of people are molested, and 1 in 4 of those who are molested are molested by women. So that takes it over to a quarter. Now, the latest statistic, which I haven't read, so I don't know what sort of a statistic it is that there's 50-50. But I don't see why pedophilia should be, or the desire to sexually molest children should be restricted to men. I think it probably is a 50-50 thing, particularly if you've been sexually molested. I don't know. What do you think, Stephen? But apparently it could be 50-50. It was a long answer, I know. Sorry.
Yeah. It wouldn't surprise me, to tell you the truth. The last 10 to 15 years, I can't tell you how many of these teachers, female teachers, have been caught molesting and raping, 14, 15, 16-year-old boys. I can think of probably, 30 or 40 cases just offhand, you know. I mean, I don't know names or anything, but I think I probably heard that many in the last 10 years.
The thing I was going to say was my uni, I was actually trained by Child and Family Services. I probably get myself into a lot of trouble here. Two of the teachers that provided our university were from Child and Family Services. Now I might go into a libel suit. But anyway, there was one woman. I don't think I'm going to continue this conversation. Well, the shortest part to say is that I actually proposed in my essay and in my conversation in tutorials that it was a feminist. I read this and I quoted somebody who wrote this, so it's actually a quoted peer-reviewed article, that that the feminists had held back on discussing female pedophilia because they were too busy trying to advance the case for feminism, and they couldn't put an anti-pedophilia, and so they couldn't lump women in as being pedophiles with the men because they were too busy trying to stop the men.
Yeah,
and they thought the men were worse.
I want to get back to the discussion that you and Bill had during your show, Jill. That was Dr. Alfred Kinsey. I actually contacted Dr. Judith Reisman last year and had her on the show. We had a nice discussion about Kinsey, the animal he was. His test subjects were ranged anywhere from 2 months until 18 years of age. They molested and raped 2-year-old children, both boys and girls. And
well, I've thought about that. I've thought, what would it be like to be raped as a 2-year-old or as a baby? Just imagine that.
Well, I don't think I could.
You just couldn't imagine. You just couldn't imagine being ripped asunder like that. Like, you just, you know, I'm talking about penetration. Like, I mean, just to go completely public on this, I couldn't even put a bloody tampon in my vagina when I was a child without being in excruciating agony. Like, I don't know. It took me weeks to get the bloody thing in. And I had to coax one of my nieces through the thing. I was going, it really hurts, but it's really worth it. Just keep on trying. You know, like, that's a bloody tampon. I can't believe how much agony it would be to do that to a child. In the vagina, or I don't know about, just terrible.
Well, yeah, but what my point was getting to, Jill, was Kinsey's science. His first book came out in 1948, the book about the men, and his second book, I believe, came out in 1953, the book about the females. And those two books are the spawning progenitors of the 60s sexual revolution and the presiding pedophilia that actually come after.
Well, it completely skews sexuality. And this is where, you know, so many people, like recently a friend of mine, Neil, said, so many people who fight pedophilia do so because they're harmed. And this is where I reckon I'm lucky, because I wasn't harmed. And yet still, and this is where it's so obviously that the sexuality is completely skewed. Like, it is skewed. Kinsey has skewed the sexuality. I don't think there was probably, well, there couldn't have been a single person who worked on those children who wasn't a pedophile, because you have to be a pedophile to masturbate a child.
Yeah.
And so much of his work, yeah, they're just pedophiles. It's just a pack of pedophiles that have influenced the entire law system, the medical system, the psychiatrists. They've just permeated all of society on false evidence, well, and so much that we worship academia.
The deception that Kinsey writes about in his two books is the test subjects. He doesn't really explain that they're pedophiles, and he also doesn't explain that they're convicted pedophiles that have been in prison.
Well, this was the point that I was trying to make with Jillian earlier, is that by definition, they're all people who we believe are criminals. We call them criminals, and we call them sick. Or deviants or whatever. But I do want to make sure people understand that Kinsey's studies were not limited to 2-year-olds to 18-year-olds. He studied people of all ages. The problem that Judith has is with that section of it, and a couple other sections too, by the way, And so she specifically brings that part of his study out. And I agree with her that it is completely skewed, especially when you're only using a small, tiny handful of cases of people. And that's why I can't believe, I wouldn't possibly believe the results. They're not repeatable. In science, you have to repeat the results in order for it to be valid. Now, he did a lot of testing with people in their 20s and 30s and 40s and older, lots of them. And, you know, she does not speak to that part of his testing, but that is another and much bigger part of what he came out with that became the predecessor to, as you said, the sexual revolution. It's not the stuff that she's objecting about, although I have a problem with it too, you know.
But I think
he did some valid work, and he opened up, he at least opened the dialogue for us to have the dialogue we're talking about now, you know.
I don't think you get how bad he's been, Bill, because I don't think you've had enough chance to look into it. This guy is like, changed the world. He's added, it's almost as though, I don't think he was actually deliberately, well, mind you, the Rockefellers did pay for him, but it's sort of like if I was a Rockefeller and I practiced pedophilia, and I'd be very happy all of a sudden if a pedophile came along and I go, ha ha, I finally found somebody who's prepared to do some studies on this. And I don't know if it was, you know, exactly planned, but they certainly, you know, jumped in on the bandwagon and made the most of this pervert and have changed the future of America. I mean, maybe you're defending the sort of sexual liberation phase that we went through, you know, but I don't know. And I didn't even know how good that was. I was wondering whether I was a victim of pedophilia when I had an affair with my girlfriend's father when I was 17 and he was 41. I've been questioning that. I'm thinking, well, that was an unbalanced relationship. That
Say, Jill,
wasn't really. Yeah, go on.
I need to let Bill respond because he's got to leave in about 2 or 3 minutes here.
Well, oh, yeah, thanks, and David. I'm not trying. I would never defend any of the aspects of the Kinsey report that deal with the children part of it, because the children were not willing participants. They were victims. Okay. But the other people in his report, and what I am defending is the need for us to understand our sexuality as a society. And he was really the first person that started to do that and made it an open topic. That's an important topic. And if he was the person that allowed the gateway, the floodgates to open so that we could have these discussions, that part of what he did has some validity to me. Now, and that's why I say you can't throw the baby out with the bathwater. The baby's really important here, and the baby is our need as a society to even acknowledge that there were differences in our sexuality. I'm talking about adult sexuality, you know, and not everything that we thought, you know, was a moral issue is, it becomes a moral issue if it's consensual and so forth. And I'm just defending the study of sexuality, period.
You know. Yeah, I get it.
Yeah, for example, and I'll tell you one more very quick thing, Stephen, and thank you for letting me have this little bit of time.
That's okay, Bill.
She complains a lot about teaching our children about sexuality in school, and she says that's completely wrong. Well, I don't agree with that either. I think our children need to be taught from the earliest age all the way up through school and in school, in age-appropriate ways about their body, the rights of that they have, how to recognize if someone has crossed a boundary and so forth, and eventually get to actual talking about biology and sexuality and the fact that there are differences in sexuality. By the time you get there, and you should get there by junior high, because all our junior high school students, whether we want to believe it or not, are sexual. They're active.
They are.
They need to know by that point that what sleeping together can cause, how to use a condom, you know, what birth control is, blah blah blah. They need to be at that point by then, but they don't need it when they're four. I get that.
Bill.
At 4 years old, they need to know that they have the right to say no, that their body is their own thing. There are certain parts of their body that are private. They should come to mom or dad or another adult and repeatedly come to us if they don't get help. You know, if they're feeling that the boundaries have been crossed, they should keep coming to us until one of us understands and gives them the assistance that they need and so forth. So you know, she's even upset that we teach children in school. Well, I'm not upset about that at all. We've needed that because most of the children are being molested at home.
Yeah, yeah.
Two-thirds of them are being molested at home. Those yes, parents aren't going to teach them.
Yes, they are.
So,
yeah. I want to leave you with a quick joke, Bill, I heard last week. I think it was rolling around Facebook there. This 16-year-old girl texts her dad and said, "Dad, you lied to me. I just went through sex education in school, and you told me that my boyfriend would die if we had sex together." And he said, "Oh no, sweetheart, he will die. He will." But it was a funny joke, I guess. But we do need to let you go here. You got to get ready for your own show, don't you, Bill?
I do, but I appreciate, you know, Jillian and Stephen and Vin, anybody that, you know, that wants to help me get the word out. That's what I'm here for. And I want to make myself available. You know, Robert mentioned that we need to get through the taboo. I don't think we're near getting through the taboo.
No, but he was right. We do need to get over it, though.
But that's one of our challenges, you know, is to turn that corner so that someday we can talk about this in conversations,
you know,
at a cocktail party.
It's funny. We can talk about homosexual marriage, gay marriage in 2014.
Because we just turned that corner with that subject.
Yeah.
That's a great example.
We just
got there.
Yeah.
And people are still confused that they think pedophilia has anything to do with being homosexual. They have nothing to do with either.
Of course not. But this is where we're still very uptight as a society to talk about things sexual at all.
Yeah, we are.
You know? So, I mean, I'm all for that. That needs to be something that we can talk about easily and not judge each other about, but say there are variations. And, you know, if you're talking about adult activity with adults, with other adults, a lot of that's valid. It may not be my choice or my validity, but I can't say it's not someone else's. Anyway, the taboo, we need to turn that same corner, Stephen, which the gay and lesbian community has just recently turned after decades of individuals coming out of the closet and saying that they were gay. We've just gotten to that place. And that's why it's so important that those of us who are survivors do the same thing. We have to come out of the closet of our abuse and our recovery. And when we are comfortable enough, and I don't ask people to do it until they're comfortable enough and healed enough, we need to be the ones that talk about it because nobody else can.
That's
the way
right.
We can.
That's right.
Yeah.
So thank you again for staying on afterwards there, Bill.
Thanks. Thanks very much, guys. I'll see you later.
Have a good night.
Thanks, Bill.
Okay. Bye-bye now.
Bye.
Okay, Jill, you want to take a quick break here, or do you want to wait 4 or 5 minutes till the hour?
You're in charge of the universe.
Well, I could use a little nature break here, so I think we'll take a break now.
Okay.
All right, everyone. We'll take a quick about four and a half to five minute break here, so we will be right back.
Okay.
All right, and welcome back, everyone. It seems that we have to say goodbye to Maggie, as she was just saying during the break here. Is that right, Maggie?
Yeah, that's correct.
Okay. Jill, you want to, did you have anything else for her before she left?
Is there anything you'd like to say, Maggie?
It was pretty good to be in here and listen to it all. Probably like to do it again sometime.
Well, that would be great. We'll come on with Bill and me as soon as you feel like it. We do it every Friday night in Ireland or every Saturday morning in Australia at the moment. We're trying to get more people to talk about what happened because with the situation going on in the world at the moment with all the politicians and all the pedophile investigations that are going on, I've realized that the most important thing we can do is get the victims who are the witnesses to their own abuse. We want the witnesses to speak, and I think it's very hard for people to speak. And this is why Bill Murray is so fabulous in encouraging people to speak, because he's always talking about what happened to him. But people, you guys, if we want to stop this, we or you, the victims, have to stand up and say, "This happened to me, and this person did this to me."
I would agree completely with what you're saying, Jill. Two things. That's part of the reason I decided to push forward with the film project, because I think in our society now, folks are more visually oriented as opposed to reading books like they used to. You know, it's just a fact of life. And being able to visually see something and connect with it, that in and of itself might help people to kind of go, "Well, that was how I felt. That was what happened to me in part." It kind of goes to something you said earlier as well in terms of characterization. you know, the idea that a predator is, you know, some ogre or unattractive, you know, three teeth and one eyeball in the center of their head is a fiction. You know, they are typically quite charismatic, attractive people, and they lure them in, and they're like a praying mantis or a spider. I mean, they literally are very good at charismatically luring a young person in that doesn't know they're being manipulated and used. So it's important that they be able to understand that and talk.
Yes, and they're also doctors, lawyers, judges, movie stars.
Steven, that's a great point. I'm sorry, I apologize. It touches every aspect of society. Race, socioeconomic, high class, low class, doesn't matter. It hits everybody. You know, they say it's 1 in 3 girls, 1 in 6 boys, and these sort of things that get bounced around. And, you know, I'm not going to question the statistic. Let's just say it's 1 in 10, for example.
Exactly.
That's still a huge number. It's everybody.
Yeah, that's still 1 in 10 too many.
Yeah, absolutely. And the thing that a poor family, the issue spills out into the street because they have no resources. But the rich family can cover it up. You know, a perfect example of that is Marilyn Van Buren, Miss America, I think 1958 or 57. And her father abused her. She is, to me, a pillar of integrity. The fact she wrote that book and came out and told people what happened to her. I mean, there's a picture of her after she won the Miss America with her father. And they said, what a perfect little family.
Yeah.
And it's just such a huge fiction.
And it was a lie. Yeah. Yeah.
It was a total.
And look at here in the last year or so now, by the last year and a half, since the new Pope here has taken over Pope Francis or whatever his name was, the allegation from Kevin Annette up in Canada is that he is a serial child molester and even a child sacrifice. They've also allegedly linked him to pedophilia and child sacrifice.
Terrible. What's extraordinary about that is that they're actually saying that since 17, and I don't remember the date and I don't have the page up in front of me at the moment, that since the late 1700s, all popes, and I don't know if it was all popes because I don't know if that one whose head fell on its side, that Pope John, he's not included on the list, Pope whose head fell on his side, but you know what I mean. I think they did something to him, but I think he was nobbled, that old pope. But anyway, nearly all popes have to, through some really weird belief that the Roman Catholic Church in the Vatican holds, that you have to go through a ninth circle, I hate to use the word, Satanist cult ritual to become a pope. Now, I know I've just contradicted myself there. Whether it's true or false, I still don't know. I don't have any evidence, but I did have a document here that had the that says it's evidential, that they do this. And a part of it is that they actually, I can't even believe I'm saying this, but I've read it again and again now, and I don't know if it's false information, but there are witnesses to both the popes. One said with Ratzinger, I think it was, that she clearly saw 9 men in red coats, cardinals, and the Pope raping, the whole 9 of them raping and then killing an infant. Like, that's just unbelievable. And yet they're saying that is going on in the Vatican and there are witnesses to it. I don't know how reliable these witnesses are, but it's shocking.
Jill, do you remember, I don't remember the film producer's name. He was actually the director, but the last movie he made was Eyes Wide Shut. Maybe somebody can remind me the name.
Stanley Kubrick.
Stanley Kubrick, that's right. There's an allegation out there, Jill, that in the sex scenes at the mansion there were men and women having sex. But there's allegations out there that he was told to cut out the adults having sex with children. And also child ritual sacrifice. And he told him he told him that he wasn't going to cut that out. And then mysteriously he died. And there was a final edit and there was none of that in there. So these things do go to the top with the Jimmy Savile allegation. Yeah. that come out 2 years ago. The British music DJ, I guess they called him, kind of like the I don't know. He was just the celebrity of the day from the 50s, 60s, and 70s. But he was also alleged to have gotten many, many children all to his own. And then he provided top elite people with children for their pleasure.
That's a huge issue. Yeah, that's another issue that's going on right now in Hollywood. I think the young man has accused a director of similar activity.
Yes, and, yes, the one that committed suicide, Corey Haim. Is that the one you're talking about?
No, there's another one that went on, and they're being defended by a law firm out of, I believe it's Boca Raton, that specialize in the area. But it's the direct. I'm having a little bit of a. I can't remember the name of the director, but they're accusing the very similar situation. I think what the root is that when someone comes forward and talks, a couple things. One is they have to be believed. And to do that takes a huge personal risk for somebody, potentially, that they're not going to be believed. Jimmy Savile is a perfect example that if any of those folks had stepped forward and said, hey, he's been, you know, out abusing my child or what have you, you know, do the authorities step forward and do something about it? Or do they push him aside because he's famous? And that person then ends up getting victimized again when they came forward, or they get accused of wanting to go out just to do it to get a bunch of money.
Sure.
And I find that that's unusual that the victim, when they come forward, are doing it to make money. I think most of them are just trying to have a cathartic moment and get some sort of justice.
Exactly. That reminds me of also 2 years back, the Jerry Sandusky case. It came out after his arrest and, you know, foregoing indictment in that the press knew about that way back in 1994. The local police in that boys area also knew about that. The FBI knew about it. ESPN knew about it. And they covered it up for 17, 18 years.
Yep.
And why do they cover it up? Because there's too many of them are able to be blackmailed. This is the problem. Once you start to be a pedophile or you get all this dirt on yourself, you can be controlled. That's another reason to give up pedophilia, folks.
It is. And I don't really know what a lot of people think about David Icke, but I think he did get this one right, because he's been saying for 20-some-odd years that pedophilia runs the world, and I'm tending to believe him that it does.
But, you know, Stephen, you talk about the Sandusky case. I mean, there were fans of that school that just didn't want to believe it. And there's another area there that the victim is unable to feel validated because they're going to be accused of being a liar. And for no other reason than to protect the football team. It's, yeah.
Yeah, well, this is what's been my dilemma this week. You know, I started my show, you know, before when I had my show, saying I just wanted to run away from it. I just didn't want to believe this. But look,
you know what she said, Robert?
I believe it. Robert. I feel like an idiot believing it, and I feel like an idiot if I don't believe it. But so I actually believe it. Sorry, Stephen.
You know what she wrote to me earlier on? I think it was yesterday, Robert. She said, God, I hate humans, or something like that.
You said what I wrote to you.
Something like that. I don't remember.
Well, the people that do not have the ability to control themselves, that don't understand what they're doing is wrong. You know, it's power and control over a child is, or any human being, is a sickness. And it is diabolical. And, you know, I go back to what you said earlier, Jill, which is a lot of these pedophiles, like Jerry Sandusky, for example, others, they're tall, attractive, good-looking people. I mean, these are not ugly folks. So, I mean, they're being protected because they're charismatic, or they, you know, it's the faith in the other human being. And then you are unfortunately disappointed over and over again that after a while you just don't trust anybody. And it's a sad commentary, I suppose, but it happens over and over and over.
Well, what I find really pathetic about the whole thing is that people are so completely deluded. You know, that people think, you know, it just people are moronically deluded, and they think, you know, they're cardinals and popes and all of these people. They think, you know, that they've finally found some portal to enlightenment by harming a child. You know, like, how bloody crazy do you have to be to believe that you need to harm somebody or sacrifice somebody to attain your own realization of your own blissful nature? Like, it's a confusion of bliss.
Well,
you know, like, yeah, go on.
It's all about power, I think, though, Jill. These men and women, they receive some type of a I think maybe the essence of a child. You know what I'm saying? The spirituality.
That's what they think.
Yeah.
That's what they think.
Well, that's what that's what a lot of them are telling the authorities in that.
If I may, Stephen, I would tell you that the end of – this is a spoiler alert, but at the end of Bobby Sox, two things that – kind of chilled me. One is what I wrote at the end effectively is that the victim, Bobby, doesn't get a I'm sorry. The language, he confronts him and he gets the character that's the predator does not say I'm sorry in any way, shape, or form. He sees nothing wrong with what he did, which goes along with what Jill just was pointing out.
Yeah.
They are pathological and they are not going to give up the fact they don't see that they did anything wrong.
Well, they're just criminals. I can add a little bit to that. My dad was a narcissist, and I'm not saying he was a psychopath or anything, but he told me one time that he said, don't ever apologize because it makes you look weak. And I'm sorry, Jill.
I just laughed.
Yeah. That might be part of their problem. Part of these people's problems, why they don't ever seem to apologize or seem to be empathic or, you know, anything like that.
Well, you know, that's the part that frustrates me is that the victim ends up shutting down. They numb themselves. They go through a lot of bad behaviors because they just simply are unable to feel anymore because they don't trust the own environment that they're in because they've been victimized, and those that have done it get away with it by and large. As Bill kind of mentioned earlier, there are thousands of these out there, and they get away with it within the family or not. It doesn't matter.
Well, this is what the problem with the Westminster cover-up, you know, like they found, and in America, like even apparently they found a whole heap of babies at Benjamin Franklin, tying it back to America and how ripe America was for Kinsey. But it's back to blackmail, sorry. It's just blackmail, 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 blackmail.
Well, certainly.
The kids are blackmailed, yeah. The politicians, the royal family, everyone's blackmailed. Look at Lord Mountbatten.
Mm. You know, Jill and Stephen, I would tell you to look up there was a video of Jerry Sandusky, and I can't believe a lawyer allowed this to happen, but he was interviewed by a New York Times reporter. So there's an experienced reporter, and she sat there and just let him talk. And I will tell you that what he said in that interview is not unlike what I wrote years earlier. And it kind of made me kind of put chills along my skin. I was just completely freaked out that he, in fact, said everything that a predator would say. If you want to hear what they think and how they look and act, watch that video of a New York Times reporter with Jerry Sandusky. And if it's not chilling to you, you just don't have a heart. I mean, he does not see that he did anything wrong.
Yeah, well, that's very often the case. People don't recognize that there's anything wrong. And that's denial, and that's cognitive dissonance and all of that stuff that we go through.
Oh, sure. Oh, sure.
Jill?
Yeah.
I thought we would also talking about Alfred Kinsey and what Robert just happened to mention, not thinking that anything is wrong, but brings up the fact that the organization here in America called NAMBLA, North American Man Boy Love Association. They've been pushing for years to try to get legislation changed on the age of consent. They don't believe that there should be an age of consent. Actually, they want to have their way with as many and as young of a boy as they can, and not have any kind of reparations.
Well, this is exactly it, and they're trying to make a perversion. And see, what people really – look, I've been analyzing this from a psychological and spiritual point of view as much as I possibly can, and I keep going, right, they're trying to find bliss, and they're confusing their sexual bliss with their heartfelt bliss. Do we agree on that point?
Certainly. Mm-hmm.
Certainly.
Yeah, exactly. And like if we could take it over to an Indian philosophy or the Chinese philosophy, I actually studied Chinese medicine for a number of years and also Tibetan sort of philosophy, so Buddhist philosophy. So for what I understand about this, and I know it from my own body too, is that we do actually operate out of different chakras, for want of a better word, in our body. Like our mind can be in our heart, or our mind can be in our head, or our mind can be in our stomach, or our mind can be in our sort of lower sexual center. Do you guys agree with that too?
Absolutely.
Yes.
Yeah, absolutely.
Yeah, yeah. And so basically, you know, what we have to do is we have to recognize the different feelings of those different sorts of sexual energies. Like, I can love somebody sexually from my heart. Do you know what I mean? Like, or from my head, like, or from my lower chakra. They're different types of attractions and different ways of connecting with people. And I really noticed that in myself.
I'll leave old Baldy out of this now, Jill.
Oh, Baldy's got nothing to do with it.
Okay.
I think, just to embrace what you're saying, I mean, I can see an attractive woman and I can immediately go, woo. But I also have the ability to go, well, that's probably not something I need to be doing. And I have a rational sense about myself. It's not unlike to me in terms of faith-based and religion. It's not God's fault that a human being is a pedophile. You know, I don't think that has anything to do with anything there. I think God is. And it creates the false narrative that they can embrace some sort of religion and we can go on all night on that, obviously, in other areas, but it creates the idea in their mind that they're rationalizing their criminal activities. And it's, you know, there are other, obviously every faith, every journey that you go on out there, if it's based on pure love and going in the proper direction, it's easy. But when it gets thrown off and you're lying and you're making things up and you're rationalizing, then it's a false narrative. It's
yeah. And you feel like you're in a different part of your body, and you are. You know, like, you can feel it when you love somebody with your heart, as opposed to when it's just a more carnal sort of experience. Like, we have different reactions to people in different ways, and they are quite visceral. So the point that I'm making about pedophilia is I think it gets people's engines going, you know, but they don't actually have the open-mindedness, the peace of mind, to be able to recognize where their boundaries should be and how they're affecting the other person that they're relating to sexually in this way.
Yeah.
They don't care.
Say, Robert, did I ask you on the phone yesterday if you knew David Scherter, or maybe in the chat?
You mentioned it, and did I do it? Not.
Okay. He's also an author. He's a survivor of do you remember the scandal back in the late 70s that was the Franklin affair that went all the way to the White House?
A little bit, yeah.
Well, it was a home for boys over in I think Nebraska, and it was a Catholic home for boys, I think.
Mm-hmm.
And they had pretty much the same kind of things going on there: ritual sacrifice and just sex slavery. He's one of the survivors of that, and I've got him coming on the first next Wednesday, Jill. I don't know. You missed the first two interviews with him. I didn't know if you wanted to join me with this one or what, Jill, but you're welcome to.
Welcome to.
Oh, thanks, Stephen. I've got my earphones off at the moment. I was about to get a coffee.
Go ahead.
So I've got it. Yep.
Me and Robert will talk.
Yeah.
Where are we at just a minute ago?
It is unfortunate beyond belief that adults look the other way. I think what empowers a predator in many ways is for folks who are in a position to do something about it, look the other way, or just ignore it and act like it's just going to go away. It's like having some sort of physical problem, and yet you think, well, it'll just go away. Well, it's not going to go away, and it's just going to make it worse.
You were a psychologist, Robert?
No.
I spent
a long time in my life dealing with you know, the medical malpractice piece, dealing with trauma. I've insured a lot of psychiatrists and psychologists, and obviously I've been to visit folks on a therapeutic basis for my own journey, and learned a lot along the way. And that's why, you know, I wouldn't have written a book at all. I'd written some other novels, but I would not have written Bobby Socks if I had not read the article about the suicide gene and the work going on at the Sackler program. That really triggered me from no other reason from anger. I wrote the book originally from an angry standpoint, and I will tell you, the ending that I have in the book is a tough ending, but it's empowering too, in that it's the old, you know, the old phrase, you know, taking you know, lemons and making it into lemonade. I mean, the character becomes empowered to do something about it, And that's the secret to the book in the end is, and I changed it. I wrote the first part of it in third person, but there's a last, very last chapter, the epilogue, where I talk in first person. And I did that on purpose, which from a writing standpoint is technically taboo. But I wanted to create a clear delineation between what happens to you as a victim, so to speak. But then the idea that you no longer have time for tears, that you're going to step up and you're going to do something about it, and you're going to become a thriver, and you're going to go out there into the world, and you're going to succeed in whatever endeavor you choose to do. You're not going to let this prohibit you from being successful. I'm lucky that I have a strong mind and a strong will. I run across folks from time to time that call me, that want to talk, and they feel they're having a hard time getting through the process. And The best advice I got from one person, one licensed social worker, in fact, I talked to just one time, he said that the literature is that you face up to it. You don't walk away from it. It's kind of like those flashbacks you get, Stephen.
Yeah.
You know, I've gotten them as well. They pop up in the worst of times. You just see it in your head. You can be in a grocery store. You can be in a...
Driving down the road.
Doesn't matter. That they show up. And being able to battle that and realize... okay, I'm not going to walk away from it. So you literally face up to it. It's empowering. And then you are no longer weak. You're strong. And that's the tough battle that folks have to get through. And it takes a while. It's not something that happens overnight. It probably prohibited me from my academic standpoint. I mean, I have some good degrees, but the reality is that the anger comes from the loss of opportunity and the loss of relationships, the loss of experiences that should have been normal and healthy, things that Bill kind of referenced between, you know, a 17-year-old boy and a 16-year-old girl or whatever, you know, it just those opportunities to build on and to understand who you are. And that's the thing that becomes valuable. And I think society has become so numb to it that we miss out on the beauty of feeling sad or happy, just yep. to feel. And I think that's the thing that's sad to me is politicians and what have you, they're about money and power and all this kind of nonsense, but they're missing out on the beauty of life, which is the experiencing love and allowing love to really foment and create this wonderful relationship with another human being. And that's to me the thing that you got to try to figure out to get to. That to me is the light at the end of the tunnel, if you will.
Well, you have a really good relationship, obviously, and you've married a really good friend and partner.
She's my best friend.
Yeah.
Period. She's my best friend. I mean, she knows everything. She's put up with me. Sometimes we've had a great relationship. Sometimes not so much. But it's you have to fight through it, and you have to recognize that as you age, as you get older, you know, your life changes, your body changes. But love, to me, is a concept that is about understanding another human being and accepting them for who they are and them accepting you for who you are. And that's a scary thing to go down that path because they may not like what they see or vice versa. And, you know, people visit and see each other. They see attractive bodies, but they can't seem to keep it together because, to me, they're basing the relationship on physicality and not friendship and the beauty of just holding someone's hand and their presence. You know, there's a famous quote about, you know your true friend when you can just be in the same room together and not say anything to each other. You just just accept each other and you accept their presence. That to me is the basis of love.
That actually happened to me with my best friend when I was young. We knew each other at school. I moved to a private school when I was 15 and, cause I lived in the country. Anyway, I went to the school and, anyway, she invited me on holidays. And they had a lovely holiday house. They called it the Patala, on a hill over a lake. And, we spent the days riding horses and we didn't talk. And she said, we have one of those, she pointed it out to me, we have one of those friendships where you don't need to talk. I mean, we'd lie in bed at night, you know, and talk all night about things. But on the daytime when we were riding, we'd just space out. And, yeah, those relations. And she has remained my friend, named my son after her, Freeman, is named after her father, who was also called Freeman. Yeah, just those relationships where it doesn't have to be sexual, you know, it's just where you don't talk. But bringing it back to boy sex and man sex and child sex, this is the point I'm trying to make, because we have to find a solution to this. This is one reason, like I'm telling you, I, not that I would have, it was only some impulses, but I really just wanted to walk away from the whole thing because I realized it was much bigger and uglier than I ever dreamed of.
Oh.
this pedophilia, you know, once you've got it into the royal family and you've got it into the Prime Minister, you know, Margaret Thatcher, as Stephen pointed out in a message to me earlier on, and the Pope, you know, you're pretty well buggered, for want of a better word. And so
this might be the best word, but we'll go on.
Yeah, I think bugger's a very good word. Well,
bugger's a nice PC word that they use over over in Australia and in England and that, right?
I think, Jill, you touch on something, though. It kind of goes back to what I said earlier, and it's part of the story of Bobby Sox, which is they have an opportunity to step forward and say, no more. We will not allow this forward. I don't care who it is. But that takes courage, and that takes real political vision. Because if you think about it, if you stop this activity, the social benefit is enormous. I mean, I can't calculate value to it.
The savings, healthcare savings would be in the hundreds of billions.
Question, because of alcoholism, drug abuse.
Yeah.
These are, you know, when you are numbed, and I know what that feels like. We all do.
How many?
You have to work through that and stop feeling numb and start to feel. And sometimes that's a scary place to go, but it costs society a lot of money to deal with. You know, the car accidents.
It does. Yeah, you have the jailing of these people. They're prosecuted. That also takes money. It takes money to jail them every single year. It's like $40,000 for an inmate, average in the U.S. I think, or something like that.
And if I may, kind of going along with that, that's part of why the idea of Bobby's socks. It to me, it was an idea of such a simple, easy way for somebody to grasp onto something. It's, you know, it's an object, obviously. It's a pair of socks, but it's a symbolic of being able to find a therapeutic device that triggers on perhaps a contentment within your own self that says, I'm going to be okay. For no other reason than you've got a pair of socks on and you're in a domestic mess. And yet you put those socks on and you feel somewhat safe. Because to me, going from my own experiences, the idea of safety was everything. Safety within the home was not there. And the idea of having a triggering mechanism that I felt safe or protected at a certain level, you know, is key. It's very important. And just for survival alone.
Yeah. I was astonished, Robert, to find out back when I first started doing this. Don't remember who was the first story I had, but it might have been David Schroeder. But I was astonished to find out that a pedophile actually doesn't get caught until like an average of 120 to 125 times after molesting a child.
Yeah,
then they finally get caught.
That I have heard that those statistics as well. I'm sure Jill has as well. And that's what makes me very angry, is because there are, if you think about it, you go to a grocery store or you go to a sporting event or whatever, go, you know, just count the people, go 1, 2, 3, 4, 5. You probably went by somebody that was molested. So when you think about it in those numbers, it gets you angry because you realize they are at war with humanity in many ways.
Yeah.
And they cause so much pain that is hidden pain that kids are not, or young adults, older people.
Oh, yes. Oh, yes.
Never say anything. I have had people tell me things just out of the blue, people that I've known for years. The fact that I was willing to step up and write that book, it's fiction by and large, but a lot of it is personal, obviously. But they felt empowered to at least tell me.
Sure.
And I think they got a benefit from that. And if that is the only thing they do, or the only thing they do is buy a pair of socks and feel more comforted, then to me, that's everything, because that gives them the basis to then heal. They got to start someplace. And just telling somebody that and trusting that relationship to me is, you know, is sacrosanct.
Master gave Dobby a sock.
There you go.
What was that, Jill?
Master gave Dobby a sock. You know, from Harry Potter, the house elf was a.
I never
free
seen
until Master gave him a sock.
I never seen the movies or read the books. So.
But you know, those books are by and large a young boy searching for his family, searching for purpose. I mean, she's a brilliant writer. The stories are so simple and yet so complex. And the brilliance in that is that if you watch it closely, he's searching for purpose, and he gets blocked here and there and everywhere against good versus evil. But it's a classic tale of humanity trying to figure out some way to find where you're supposed to go. And it's tough.
Yeah, absolutely. It is tough. And Jimmy has just actually put in the chat here, unfortunately, Jill, if a soul wants to play the religious or political game, it is essential that they are corruptible. I'm going to debate this, Jimmy, but I suppose you're talking about the game. Thus, the fact that Pope Francis is up to his neck in this shit comes as no surprise to me. So basically, we're talking about the corruptibility. Sorry.
I get where he's saying with that, but at least he's willing to get into shit.
Who's willing to get in what shit?
The corruptibility, to be able to go out there and actually confront and get into the issue, as opposed to walking away from it.
Yeah.
I hearten to that instead of turning the back, he may have to, almost like having a gun pointed at your head, but, yeah. If he has the courage to actually talk about it and get it out there, I think that's a good thing, not a bad thing.
Say, Jill, would you like to bring up the ideas of a couple of, well, one was a former host and the other was a quite long former guest of yours. They both had the idea that there's a little bit of pedophilia in everyone.
Well, this is a Kinsey thing, which is why you've led into it, Stephen. This is a Kinsey thing. I don't really...
We don't need to say any names or anything,
You have to be an adult to decide that there's pedophilia in you. You know what I mean? Like, a child can't say, I've got a pedophile in me. So my question would be, if there is a bit of pedophilia in you, what has instigated it and what do you think a pedophile is? Because it's like I said in the break between the shows, I think they should have as many different names for pedophilia as they Eskimos have for snow. There's so many varieties of pedophilia, but I'm merging two topics there. But your question, Stephen, is there a bit of pedophilia in every one of you? Well, look, there's one way that I would like to analyze that, and that is if I break myself wide open, right, and I have the potential for everything within my consciousness, which I need to be able to examine to be able to recognize or accept it in someone else if I'm trying to be in a non-judgmental position. Like for example, I decided I had to imagine what it would be like the other day to be raped as an infant, and that's a horrendous thought, to think, imagine how... the agony of that. Well, the same, if you imagine the pedophile in you, I don't know if you water, can water the seed of pedophilia in yourself or what, but I think, when I try to imagine myself as a pedophile, because I always try to bring it back to myself.
Jill, you have to think about whether you have psychopathic tendencies or not, because a child is going to scream. And you have to think how you are going to react when that child does scream.
Yeah, well, you see, there's a difference again, isn't it? Because, I mean, you could just kiss your baby's dick, right? Kiss your baby's penis. Now, is that pedophilia? If you didn't feel any sexual attraction to your child when you did it, but you figured, oh, well, there are all these appendages and I'll kiss that one as well. But if I saw a man kissing my baby's, my daughter's genitals, I would immediately be assuming he was a pedophile.
Well,
you know what I mean?
I think both cases would be the
snowflakes.
Same, though. Snowflakes.
But I'm saying this is, the Eskimos have 28 words or 50 words for a different type of snowflake. Like, when you're saying you have to be a psychopath to be a pedophile, some of these pedophiles...
I'm just thinking you might have to be.
Right.
Or sociopath.
Or sociopath, yes.
Is more to the point. And you can be extremely bright and quite successful in business, doctor, like you said earlier, lawyer, whatever, and still be, a predator. It's your sexual compunction is, you don't have a rational mind. And because you don't have a rational mind, you talk to these folks and they all have a different story. The other part of that equation, of course, is there's no Richter scale for the victim. I mean, one person might be victimized one time. One might be victimized over a course of several years. How they decide, it depends. I mean, it's almost like snowflakes in that scenario as well, Jill.
Yeah, it's got to be sexual, doesn't it? Like, I mean, if you feel sexually attracted to a child, then you've got pedophile tendencies, or you're a pedophile, even if you haven't acted out on it. That's where I decided my bottom line was, and thank God I haven't wanted to have sex with any children. So the answer to your question is, Stephen, no, I'm not a pedophile. And I don't think so therefore, if I'm not a pedophile, there's no that proves that there's...
Same here.
Not everybody is
same
a
here,
pedophile.
Jill. Same here.
And since I live in the United States, if the NSA is listening, I am not a pedophile as well. No.
Believe me, Robert, they are listening.
but you have a rational mind, and a rational person doesn't do typically irrational things. And that's the delineating line, is you just don't even think about it. Whereas someone who I just find it beyond my ability to understand and put myself in their socks. I just don't understand why they could possibly terrorize a beautiful little child.
Yes.
When I see a child, yes. I kind of feel a bit defensive.
Yes. In, same here.
In the sense, I want to defend this little guy or gal and let them live their early life as happy as possible, because, you know, I didn't get that. But I want them to have it.
And you know what, Robert? These people that do these terrible things to children, they might be one of the first people to step up and jump in and save a child if that child is being harmed.
Yeah.
Some other kind of a way.
Yeah. No, they're very manipulative.
And that's what's really sad about it.
Somebody asked me, my friend who's the movie producer out in Hollywood, he asked me if I could imagine the character of Mr. Diabolus, who would I imagine? And I came up, believe it or not, with Brad Pitt or, some attractive, charismatic person. Those seem to be the typical type personalities that are, serial in nature. I mean, they're very, very brilliant sociopaths. Ted Bundy was a good looking guy and he was a killer.
He was,
So you can't go by what's going on the outside. That kind of goes into my whole epigenetic little slant to all this. But it's what goes on behind the eyeballs, and you don't know. And that's the scary thing about it. And if you try to put yourself in their shoes, Jill, I can't. I don't want to go there, I guess. But by the same token, I just cannot imagine my own person doing something to another human being along that line. I just can't imagine it, I guess.
Yeah, you can't visualize past the first couple of seconds. Do you know what I mean? And then there's a sort of a pullback, like a revulsion, and you can't go beyond that, because what's the point? Anyway, why would you want to keep thinking those thoughts in your mind? Yet if you think how the mind is sort of constructed and socialized in many ways by experience, then for some people those imprints do take root and they do grow. I don't think many people are actually born a pedophile. I really think it must be learned behavior.
There's a comment by Jimmy in the chat room there. It says, that's not true. Folk who seem rational don't do irrational things. It happens every day. What about suicide?
Well, there are two arguments, because basically, suicide, I've had a lot to do with suicide, and you know, I've hardly, nearly every single person who I've spoken to who's had a failed suicide attempt has actually been incredibly tired. They always tell me the story, and it's always, and I didn't sleep, and then that night I rattled around doing this and this, and on. So I don't think people who suicide are actually all that rational.
I think you get into a position where you just don't have any hope. You can be a very bright, attractive person. I had a friend of mine that a couple years ago, she was very smart, but she was in a failed relationship, and she had a dark side to her, and she was at a weak moment, and that was it. She's no longer with us. And she had read the book, and I talked to her. Very rational person, normally. But you get into situations where, and I think that's what attacks a younger person more so than an older person, if I will. I think a younger person doesn't see forward into the future, that they can get past this. Whereas an older person realizes they've had some experience in their life, and they can kind of work through their problem. So.
Well, that's what you were saying earlier on, that the frontal lobes don't sort of really sort of properly connect up, you know, which is planning and consequences until people are in their mid-20s.
Right. Mm. Yeah, that's the point of that. Yeah,
Yeah, and that's really quite hard to believe when you're 20.
Right. You think you're a whole person, but in fact, you're still growing as a human being. And I guess to a certain extent, we all grow as we get older if we're open to it. We don't reverse that. But when you're 18 years old and you just feel a sense of I have no options, and you are in a position where you have access to something that can kill you. Some kids do it, and is that irrational or rational? It's a great question. It's a problem. I think that I don't know that I have an answer, but I do know that they've linked it obviously to a change in your genetic code, your structure, how it propagates and mutates, and it can be reversible.
Stuart Twemlow, who was a Harvard, not a Harvard trained, but a influenced by Kinsey in a lot of ways, but a psychiatrist who we've had on a lot of shows, his theory on suicide is that it's anger turned inwards. Like if you really, you either want to kill someone or kill yourself, but it's a form of fury.
From my own personal experience, I would say that there's some truth to that. The reason I say that is I said earlier that I wrote Bobby Socks out of anger. Anger at the fact that I didn't realize when I was that age that there was science to back up my feelings, that I wasn't crazy, that I wasn't gay, that I was just having a point in my life where I really needed to have some sort of moment to let it go, let that fury, that anger out. Because I think there's a lot of truth in that you just get tired of the fight, if you will. And, you gotta have some perspective some way. And that's the great thing with therapy. It gives people the ability to get some perspective and create their own bag of tools to be able to deal with life, because life doesn't get easier. You get everything thrown at you, and you just gotta figure out a way to chop through all the nonsense and be able to focus in on what matters to you and seek your own happiness in whatever form that is. And it's tough.
Well, my best friend, who I mentioned earlier in this show, his brother committed suicide when he was 17. Mm. And so I've spent a lot of time thinking about suicide. And I actually wrote a play on it, which is rattling around in one of the cupboards in my house. I really would like to. I've written 65 pages of it. I really should go and dig it up because it's not on a computer anymore. But anyway, basically, it's based on Hamlet's soliloquy, to be or not to be, that is the question, whether it is nobler in the mind to suffer the slings and arrows of outrageous fortune or to take arms against a sea of troubles and by opposing end them. It's actually an extraordinary, Shakespeare was really extraordinary about that. He goes, to die, to sleep no more, to sleep perchance to dream. Ah, there's the rub, for in that sleep of death, what dreams may come when we have shuffled off this mortal coil. Must give us pause. There's the respect that makes calamity of so long life, But anyway, it goes something like that. That's probably vaguely it anyway, but there's a lot more to it than that. But basically, I've actually used that in counseling young kids. I had a kid who was telling me he was going to kill himself, and I said, oh, yeah, and then what? And then he goes, well, this was a story. I actually got into a lot of trouble at university for this counseling session because this was when I was at first year, and they said, Jilly, you've just done a third year intervention as a first year student and you're not allowed to do that, which I thought was a hilarious thing to get into trouble for. But there was this boy who was telling me he was going to kill himself after he went to a court case for breaking his sister's arm. We talked through how he'd go through the first court case, and he was fine with that. And then when we got to the second one, I said, what are you going to do in the second court case? And he said, oh, well, by then I'll be dead. And I said, and then? And he said, well, I'll be dead. And I said, and then? And he goes, well, when you're dead, Jill. And I said, yeah, but what if you see a ghost or something like that? And, who would fiddles bear to grunt and sweat under a weary life, but that the dread of something after death? This is why I'm saying this guy's so clever. So right on cue, up walked an Aboriginal boy. And I said to him, blah, blah, because you have to call everyone blah, blah, because they can't have a real name, because this is a true story. Blah, blah, have you ever seen a ghost? And he goes, have I seen a ghost? And he said, oh, there was one sitting in my lounge room with big red googly eyes. And just, he just told a few ghost stories. And so my boy, who I was counseling, we were sitting on the lawn, actually just jumped up and hugged me and hugged the Aboriginal boy. And there was no way he was going to kill himself because he'd actually thought of the consequences of what happens after you die. You know, like people think just to kill yourself might be the end, but so many people have seen ghosts. And this is the sort of argument that I use very successfully, or I have used in the past very successfully with kids, and even my own kid who was going through extreme trauma, my oldest son, with a marriage breakup. He said, don't worry, there's no way I'm going to kill myself, because he's been brainwashed by me all his life, because I, you know, like, I don't know what's going to happen after, you know, death.
But it's great that he was able, the young boy was able to talk and, yes, and express himself and create some sort of perspective there, that he kind of went, all right, I kind of see where I'm going with this. And he, you know, he didn't do something that would be permanent. I mean, whereas other kids don't have that, they don't have that venue, and they don't have that thought in their head that it's not worth it. The courage is living. The courage is going through and seeking your purpose. I mean, that takes, you know, because a lot of folks, like, you know, Julia Child, she didn't become successful until she was in her 50s. So, I mean, you never know, but you got to have that perspective to say, you know, I'm going to do the best I can with what I got and keep going forward. I'm not going to quit. And it's tough when you're that age, and it's great that he had that perspective and you provided it for him.
Yeah, well, actually, I just actually trying to spread the word on that idea, you know, getting people to think about what happens after you die. You know, like, I mean, so many people,
Well, I'm probably a bad person to talk about, because I grew up Southern Baptist and grew up in a very religious family that the preoccupation is always on death and not living, unfortunately.
Yeah.
And
always,
but like, if you die tomorrow, are you going to go to heaven? This kind of stuff. And it's like, well, I'm 9. I want to live. I want to find out what that girl over there, what she looks like without the top on or whatever. I mean, you know, it's about living, going forward. That's maybe the value of some other religions and faiths and views, but you know, when you grow up in that prism where you just don't see any other option, and that, oh my God, I'm gonna burn in hell. I mean, it's pretty restrictive.
Well, that's why I'm bringing it back to Shakespeare. You know, where he says puzzles the will, that, you know, confuses the plan. You know, like, makes us rather bear those ills we have than fly to others that we know not of. You know, like, I mean, it, you know, that's what that's really saying there. Thus consciousness make coward of us, and cowards of us, and thus the native hue of resolution is sickled all with a pale cast of thought. So I actually think Shakespeare gave an enormous present to the world, though, mind you, Hamlet did kill himself in the end anyway, so it didn't even work.
I think that's part of the reason that I think it's good to talk about those very issues, because instead of them, as Bill had said earlier, you know, taking away that taboo and kind of confronting it and saying, you know, you can work through this, it gives some young person perspective that says, okay, I see what's going on here. And then they may just talk among themselves. They may not say anything to you at all. But if they have that ability to then kind of link into it and realize that that's not a good option, you have so much value out there in the world that you maybe don't hear that at home, but in fact you do. You know, they can kind of say, all right, I got to get through these next 5 years, but then I'm going to go on my own and I'll figure it out from there. I mean, that takes a certain degree of personal will, but if they at least have the conversation and at least the issue is brought before them, they at least are informed, and that hopefully it'll spark some sort of, you know, positive aspect to their life.
I'm leaving a gap for you here, Stephen.
Oh,
you want to say something?
Well, I don't know. We didn't really have a whole lot of time left here. Robert just wanted 2 hours. He didn't really think he could fill up 2 hours, but I thought we could. There's a lot of discussions. I just thought there's a lot of people that listen and don't sign up to the chat room. So I thought maybe we could give everybody the links in the chat and tell them how to find the book. And maybe I think you said you had a quick start or something like that?
Kickstarter, yes. It's a crowdfunding mechanism. What we're trying to do is, you know, because putting a film up and getting it financed is, on the front end in particular, is tough, because you got to go out and get a bankable star. There's all sorts of nuances that you have to go through. That just takes money. And I think we have a solid script. I adapted to the book. To a film, it's roughly just under 2 hours long. And I will tell you that the ending does confront unintended consequences. You know, a lot of gun laws we have here in the States, a lot of those sort of things that are absolute that I just kind of shrugged my shoulders. There's no nuance to it at all, and there's no judgment. And I felt like that if it was set up such that we didn't walk away from it, that we really took on a tough subject. To me, that's the value of art, is taking on tough subjects and looking at them in a different perspective. And so, yeah, we have a Kickstarter campaign up. We'll see if we can get there or not. We're going to try, at least. The book is out on Amazon. It's been out there for a while. And it's got a little boy with tape across his mouth. I never marketed the book, Stephen or Jill, because I just, you know, at the time, it was more cathartic for me, I guess, to write it than to feel like I was making money, because that wasn't my purpose.
Go ahead, Jill.
Thank you. It's an incredibly important book to write. It's an incredibly important conversation to be had. And, you know, to bring pedophilia and being a victim or being a victim of sexual abuse and also suicide, they're all completely taboo subjects that are just starting to open the lid on themselves at the moment. And thank you so much for contributing to the information in the world, Robert.
I
hope your film gets made. Sounds like it will
yeah,
be.
Yeah. We just wanted to mention the Kickstarter program. You can go to Kickstarter and look up Bobby's Socks.
You go to a film and then go to drama, and then it'll be there. And we're trying to move it along. We have, as I mentioned, it's not just me. I have a director guild member involved with this who's got a lot of experience about how to finance these things. And that's the front end of this, is to move it forward to at least try to get it out there. And it's a tough subject, but I think Hollywood, and I think film in particular, is open to it. It's not a story about me. It's a story about someone else, a fictional character. Because I think, as Jill pointed out, you remember Hamlet. You remember Tom Sawyer. You remember those characters. If you take it away from an individual human being, I think sometimes it makes it easier for people to access and to remember. Because they, for whatever reason, in terms of how we view things, we link up with characters. We don't necessarily link with people. So that's my thinking behind it. I want it to be an artistic moment to somebody to look at it, and if they see the film, they might get in their car and they may tell the person that they're a partner with. That's kind of how I felt when I was a kid. They may not say it in front of anybody else, but it creates the groundwork for them to then talk to somebody, and then you see where it goes from there. There's a beauty in honesty, I think, and but it's tough to get there.
Yes, absolutely. And whoever would like to go to Amazon.com and look in the book section, that is also Bobby's Socks.
Yep, it's there.
Or you can look for Nathaniel Sewell.
And yeah, we have NathanielSewell.com is my our website.
Okay.
And so thank you for mentioning that. I really appreciate y'all having me on tonight. I have found the conversation very, very interesting and very appreciative to talk about these subjects.
Well, this isn't our first rodeo, is it, Jill? So.
No, we didn't mean to end up here, you know. It was just that people so much needed to have these conversations on radio about being victims of abuse that I fell into this conversation along with Stephen.
Yep. And well, I thank you all for having me on.
Yes, thank you, Robert. I'm just going to go ahead and sign off here, and then we can talk on Skype for a few minutes, I think, if we want. Yes, so thank you, everyone. It's early Saturday morning over there in Ireland, Scotland, UK, and elsewhere. It's still Friday here in America, so we'll see everyone next week. I'm Stephen Roberts, and this has been Cancel the Cabal. Good night, everyone.